You can have all the Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio podcast with our new app. Just search your app store, Apple, Android, Kindle. We don't care what you use. Search the app store for Explorations Early Learning. Download the app. Give it a try. Welcome to another episode of the Child Care Bar and Grill Podcast. I'm Jeff Johnson coming to you live from upstairs studio. In the studio with me is Travis Taggart. How you doing, Travis?
Good, I'm great.
On the phone is Nikki Buchan from Australia, 15 hours in the future. How you doing, Nikki?
I'm doing very well. Glad to be speaking to you.
Are you hearing me okay?
I can hear you well now, yes.
Okay, great. Good. We got that fixed.
Even though you're 15 hours behind me.
Out of the studio, Lisa Murphy and Tiffany, our engineer, are down in the kitchen stirring something. They had to run out between recordings with Nikki to take care of something in the kitchen, but they will be back to join us. We are talking about risky play today with Nikki. Nikki and I spent about 3 weeks running around Australia talking risky play a lot, and I think it's a topic that Travis spends a lot of time thinking about too, and has some thoughts on. And so where are we all at with risky play? A good thing or bad thing for young children?
It's an amazing thing.
It's an amazing thing.
I guess I'll be the first one to say it.
I second that. I think that's life. Life is about risk and challenge and exciting stuff.
And conflict.
Yes.
That even goes in there with all that, because a lot of times... We're shielding them from all the physical stuff, and then we're also shielding them from the emotional stuff, and it's just, why? It's just one big question, why?
And so what's the problem that so many adults have with this kind of play? Is it that it's so risky, or so emotionally messy, so potentially, not majorly, but potentially physically dangerous? Why do we adults get so worked up about risky play sometimes?
I'll answer. Just because I think... we feel that our role is to protect children from every little bit of bump and scrape. And I think, I know in the U.S., or you have the reputation in the U.S. that everybody sues everybody, and that's another big issue. I think it's sort of filtering to Australia a bit and to the U.K. a bit, although there's no actual evidence of that actually being successful. So people are scared for themselves.
Yeah, I completely agree. And Nikki and I have talked about this other places. In the U.S., I hear all the time, we can't do that because we're going to get sued. And when I do presentations on this topic, I ask, how many of you have been sued? And I rarely see a hand go up. And I've been asking this question for 2 or 3 years every time I talk about the topic. And if a hand goes up, I say, how did it turn out? And usually the suit was dropped. And if it wasn't dropped, the settlement was in the favor of the program. And if the settlement wasn't in the favor of the program, and there was a judgment against the program, it was because they were liable, because they were doing something that was against their policies or against their procedures, or was negligent, and so they should have been sued, and they should have lost in court. And so I think we build up a lot of fear about the litigation thing, but I don't think the reality, the evidence is there to make it a real problem. I think it's a boogeyman. It's something we're scared of.
Yeah, and it's also, there's the whole thing where a lot of people view children and childhood as a nuisance, just in like, even so, like subconsciously, that any single time a kid's crying, they sued them not because they really want to sue them. They sued them because they don't want to hear the crying, and they don't want to take the trip to the hospital. They don't want to. They don't want to spend the time doing the real supervision that needs to happen in those first few times when it's still novel. It's just, it's crazy. Some people just really are that intense about making sure children never have a negative experience with anything because they don't want to deal with the fallout. It's not because they want to protect them. It's because they don't want to deal with the fallout of what comes next and the heavy conversations that come around that.
Yeah, I would agree that people don't want to deal with a fallout. And also there's a perception that you were negligent. And one of the things I say when I talk about risk is to tell educators to stop filling in stupid accident forms. You know, we spend a lot of time filling in accident forms for every little scrape and scratch that children have, you know, what I would call normal childhood badges of honor, really.
Yeah.
Spend a lot of time filling in those stupid forms. And my view is every time we give a parent one of those forms, we're actually saying to the parent, we're actually admitting negligence.
Yeah.
We're saying we weren't supervising. So your child, it was so serious, that little scrape, that we've had to fill in a form. We've had to do paperwork.
Yeah.
And I think we have to stop doing that.
Yeah. And I think if you're in a situation where it's required, like if you've got a lot of foster care kids, like I know here, or at least in my state, if you have foster care kids, every little scrape on their body has to be documented immediately for the foster parents so that they don't get in any trouble for that. And so I think even if the first step is changing the word accident to something a little more owning it, like just calling it an injury or saying that it was that, like, we got a bumper, a scrape, like making sure that the wording you're using isn't just incriminating like that to where it's kind of a bad thing if you have to fill it out.
Yeah. So it's a bit like those, you know, when I hire cars, and I wrote a blog post about this, when I hire cars, then, you know, you get that little form that's got the picture of the car in it, and it indicates where all the damage is. Then they say that, you know, normal wear and tear doesn't count. So they tell you anything under so big doesn't count. You don't have to, you know, that doesn't have to be marked. And I'm sort of thinking maybe we should look at that and say, you know, there are certain things that we can just say that's a little scrape or a carpet burn or, you know, they don't have to be notified. It's more if there's blood or if there's...
Yeah.
And, but that would be only for the foster children, I would say, for you know, other children that are going back to their families at night, you know, it doesn't have to even have that in it. It's more the really serious stuff we need to, you know, notify.
And so maybe we should have those just the outline of a child, and every morning we have to inspect the child and fill out every scratch and scrape they have on them, and then do one at the end of the day so we can keep track of where the bumps and bruises are happening. Maybe, you know, that'd probably be more work than we wanted to do.
I think that's about the amount of work that a lot of people are doing.
That's what we are doing.
Some people admit that they're filling in, you know, 10, 20, depending on the size of the service, filling in a lot of these forms.
Yeah, and so Nikki, we've talked about this before, but can you go through your list of when you think we should fill out the incident reports? Because for me, it makes a lot of sense.
Okay, so in Australia, the regulations say that we have to fill in an accident form if the child has reasonably needed medical attention. So it's not for a splinter or something, but people have interpreted that any little bump and scrape needs to be reported. And I always say to people, my common sense, and I think what we have lost when we look at risk is that ability to use our common sense. My common sense tells me there's four times or four reasons I will fill out an accident form. One is any head injury, just because you can't see, you know, so any sort of head injury, not a little scrape, but if two children have collided or something, I would fill in an accident form. The other one would be if a child is unduly distressed. So they've had a fall, but, you know, there's nothing really to see. Uh-huh. And I would still fill in a form because if a child cries a lot or is unduly distressed, it could just be that they didn't sleep well last night, but it could also be that it's, you know, I'm not a, you know, I can't see, I don't have x-ray eyes, I can't see what's happening inside.
Yeah.
The next one is any intentional injury. Mm-hmm. So, because I think that's parents' biggest concern is that their child is being bullied.
Mm-hmm.
So any intentional injury, so a bite or a child who has hit another child with a stick or intentionally poked them, not accidentally, that I would just verbally report, but intentionally, just to say to the parents, this has happened, you know, we're aware of it and, you know, we're obviously monitoring it. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is any high impact injury. In other words, a child's fallen and the ground has shook, was walked into a pole. And even though they might not be crying, and again, there could be, you know, you never know. I know of one case where a child fell and there was nothing visible. The child cried for a few minutes, but about 2 weeks later, they discovered that the child had cracked all the molar teeth.
Yeah.
With the impact. So those are the four times I would fill in an accident form. Otherwise, when the parent comes, I will just say to the parent, you know, they had an amazing day. They built this huge den with the sticks. And yes, he's got a little scrape on his leg, because, you know, but you should see what they've built. But,
yeah.
You know, just to raise awareness with the parents that you are aware of it, but it wasn't serious enough to do anything about it.
Yeah, there's so many of those things that don't warrant all the paperwork. And so if you're in a program, Nikki, that is used to doing one of these reports for every little scrape or scrap or scratch that happens, every little bump and bruise, how do you make the transition from that to this more sensible, less reactive process that you're suggesting? Is it something... do we need to inform parents of the change, or how do we bring parents along on this transformation, I guess, is what I'm asking.
I think if you can meet with the parents in a parents' evening, that would be the best. If not, maybe a newsletter to say you've been reflecting and you've been thinking back to your childhoods and the fun you had as a child, and that, you know, bumps and bruises were normal in everyday practice, and that in future you know, you're going to be changing, and you're only going to be reporting for those four incidents, so that parents know you have thought about it. It's not just because you're being lazy, mm-hmm. but just because you are now acknowledging that children need those bumps and bruises. It's part of childhood, and I'm sure that parents have the same. And I would even go as far as, you know, if you want to make it a bit humorous, is to say to the parents, well, if we have to fill in one for every scrape and scratch, then maybe you should be doing the same. So when your child has a scrape or scratch at home, you should be reporting it to us so that we know.
So we don't have to ask everybody.
Yeah.
Did this happen here?
And so, Nikki, I'm also, you know, when we talk about risk, I think the vast majority of the time we automatically start thinking about physical risk. But are there other kinds of risks involved in the early learning programs, and maybe things that we don't pay enough attention to, emotional risks and social risks and those kind of things?
Oh, definitely. I think we focus on physical risk because it is obvious. We can count how many Band-Aids or plasters we've put on. We can count, you know, how many accident forms we've filled in. But what we're forgetting is the harm that we do to children by preventing a lot of the play that could cause a scrape or a scratch, and how that affects them emotionally and socially. And I think, you know, children have to take risk. Risk just means you take a chance. And I don't know where lots of the definitions came from, but if you look at risk, you know, the common sense look at what does risk actually mean, it just means you don't know what the consequences are. So when you want to join a group of children playing, you take a social risk by wanting to join in, because they could reject you.
Yeah.
Some children are devastated by rejection.
Uh-huh.
Others just shrug it off because they've got the resilience. You know, and even just to having a go at doing a math sum, or picking up a book and trying to read it when you're a starter reader, that you take a risk doing that, because it could be that you can't read that book yet. And then are you going to consider yourself a failure, or do you just say, oh, that didn't work, I'll try a different one? Mm-hmm. So I think Lady Jane Allen talks. She's a lady in the UK, and she created the first adventure playgrounds for children with disabilities. And some beautiful video, YouTube videos, if you want to Google it and have a look at these, you know, and children with, obviously, we've had polio with legs in splints and going on the zip wires, and just a really exciting space for children. And she always says, rather a broken bone than a broken spirit, because a broken bone heals and a broken spirit might never heal. So I think we need to go past the physical risk taking and see risk as it's an opportunity. You know, we It just means you don't know what the consequences are going to be.
Yeah, and I love that quote. Nikki Tiffany's joined us again, and she's going to make a face at me because I touched dials on the monitor. Nikki wasn't hearing us too well, and so I pulled up the master audio. So that's the only thing I think I did. So Nikki, how that emotional risk is a big thing, because I remember being a kid, and I was an awkward, goofy. I guess I was like I am now, awkward and goofy. And so taking that emotional risk sometime, asking that kid you never played with before if they want to play, or trying the new thing, it was always hard for me. And so what can we do to be better at supporting the social and emotional risks involved in early learning programs?
I personally believe that children should have opportunities to play without adult interference. So that freedom where they think we're not watching them, and they can get down to playing, and preferably with mixed ages, because the mixed ages, they knock the corners off us, off the pedal. Because when you're playing with a group of children, the interaction between the children is fascinating to watch if there's no adult. And sometimes they say stuff that we as an adult think, oh, that's not very kind. But that's how children sort themselves out. And if you're not being nice, you're not going to have any friends. So generally, children know that, so-and-so said that, but it's just part of growing up and knowing, what you can say, what you can't say. And yes, you might say something and somebody gets upset, and then they go run to their mothers, and then you think, oh, I'm not going to do that again. But yeah. You've learned that through play. Definitely... Play is the answer, without adults telling them.
A group of mixed age kids are very effective at coming up with these cultural norms about how we treat other people and how we behave. But when there's a well intentioned adult standing there all the time telling them to be nice, we're all friends here, it kind of gets in the way of the real learning.
We can't all be friends.
Yeah, we're not all friends all the time, and it's impossible to be nice all the time. And so we set up unrealistic expectations for them, and then they get scared of taking any additional social or emotional risks.
Yeah, they just get scared of life. That's the level of children that are now suffering from anxiety, even very young children. Really scares me, and I'm just thinking, why should these young children, even 4 or 5 year olds or even younger, have these high levels of anxiety? They could have catastrophic long term, sort of permanent consequences for that child, and I think it's because we make them scared of everything in the world. That's my sort of personal belief in that one.
Yeah, and I feel I agree with you 100%, and I see it. And other in programs and out in the world, I was wondering how you feel about caregivers in the environment. And this is something we've talked about other places. Out in the playground, when it comes to risk, what should the role of the adult be? How should we handle ourselves?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is step back. So that you've got a better perspective and an overview of what's happening. And then actually, because again, as the adult in a caregiving environment, you know your children and you know what their capabilities are. And this weekend I was working in a place called Tamworth, and they have lots of loose part play, a bit of artificial turf, but lots of pallets. And I watched this one little boy, and he had a one layer pallet. And he leaned it against some others, against a den that they've just built, and he started climbing it. Now, he must have been one of the 4-year-olds, say one of the slightly older children, and I was photographing. And I watched, I could see that this thing he'd leant against the den was slipping. And, okay, I could have shouted, but I couldn't have stopped it. It was already too far. But also because of the age and the size of the child and the fact that he's in this environment, I watched and I actually photographed the whole sequence. Of the thing collapsing, him staying upright and landing on his feet with that. Now, that comes with experience. That comes with having tried, jumping off things at a low height when he was younger. If it had been a baby or a toddler, I wouldn't even have been photographing even the initial photograph. Mm-hmm. I would have gone and checked that that was solid enough for that child. So we talk a lot about doing dynamic risk assessments. So stepping back, getting an overview of what's happening, and then dynamically assessing on that moment, do I need to interfere? But as I say, with this particular case, because of the age of the child, the environment that he's in, that play environment that he's in, where they take a lot of risks and they've been building with these dens with pallets, I didn't feel I needed to stop him from climbing. Whereas if it had been a baby or a toddler, I might have. So I think the important bit is the adult just stepping away
and
giving children that space, but constantly observing and watching and reflecting and analyzing, because I think that's our role. Our role is not to be a babysitter and to constantly supervise, but more to facilitate and allow some accidents to happen, because you learn through experience.
Well, I want to come back to allow some accidents to happen in a minute, because I want to dig into that crunchy nugget of goodness a little bit deeper. But before we go there, I also want to point out that what I heard you say when we were speaking together, when we were talking about this, is not only step back, but step back and sit down.
Sit down.
And I really like that image. And I wanted to wait till we got to this until Lisa Murphy got back in the room, because I thought Lisa was going to enjoy
my sip of wine.
With her sip of wine, enjoy consuming this too.
That's not fair.
And
it's too early for me to have anything.
Oh, bull.
I'm a sip of water.
and so, Nikki, why should we step back and sit down? What's the value of the sitting down?
Well, I think if you're sitting down, then if we believe in circle of security, so children know where to find us. They know there's usually a teacher sitting on that bench outside, or the sofa inside, or on a log outside. So children know where to find us. It stops us from interfering, because even just by when children are engaged in play and somebody comes past and makes a comment, we're actually interfering, because the child has to stop that flow, the play flow, and has to look up or respond. And then it's just, oh, she said, I'm a good girl again, or something. And then they go back. So, and the third thing is, it stops us from constantly tidying up. And I find in early childcare, we've got obsessive tidy uppers. Now, I'm not an obsessive tidy upper. I mean, people know my house. I'm not an obsessive tidy upper. But sometimes children are playing, and the adult is like a vacuum cleaner behind them, sucking up things that they've put down, which they might want to come back to. So those are the main reasons I like adults to sit. But it also gives you the opportunity to have an overview of what's happening in the space. So you can see that little girl that's always telling you that little boy hurts her, is that actually she's the instigator, and he's just retaliating, because girls are very good at that. So I feel if we sit down, and we're also not these towering adults. You know, it's like a prison yard with adults that are constantly monitoring us.
Yeah, when we're always standing up, it's like we're prison guards.
Yeah, yeah. But that's why I say we're not supervisors or babysitters. We are professional, and that's where we do the observations, the assessment, and looking what the children are doing, and how can we support that next time. It doesn't have to be now. We don't have to jump in. We can do that this afternoon, or we can do that tomorrow. Yeah. And that's my reason for sitting down.
Yeah, and I love that idea of staying put, because like you say, when a child is having a moment, they know where to look for that adult reassurance. I see it with grandbaby when I take her to the playground. I sit down on the bench, and if she's climbing something she's never climbed before, or in a situation she's never been in before, I get that just that momentary glance. And just that eye contact is enough reassurance to help her keep going. But when we're constantly in motion, tidying up, like you say, or doing whatever it is that adults feel like they need to be doing to keep busy in the outdoors play space, it's hard for children to know where we are and find us for those moments when they need that momentary connection with us, or when there really is an issue that I need an adult moment where they need to need to pull us in.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Lisa's raising her hand. Lisa's got something.
I'm back at the sit down for. Well,
okay.
I love it. I'm talking it through for maybe our listeners, or maybe perhaps even for myself, because I wrote two things down frantically while you were talking. One, my first thought when it first fell out of your mouth was, well, now they have to get up intentionally.
Yes.
So now, instead of standing up and always being hovering over you in the first place, if I've sat down, I might now start thinking about whether or not the reason I'm getting up is worth my energy.
Yes, and worth interfering with what the children are doing.
Right, so I might start that whole investigative process on my own because I might be enjoying just sitting down. So maybe the thing I thought required my attention actually really in the big grand scheme of things didn't actually require me to have it. So I might start like running my own self through this process. That was the first thing I thought of. And I think that's awesome. The second thing though, and I'm speaking perhaps from educators here in, I know I try and say US because that's my experience, but perhaps North America. We're told we're supposed to be up and engaged and moving around mm-hmm. and involved. And this, although I love it, at face value without unpacking it, goes completely against what they're told or what they think they've been told that they should be doing. So now I can see a lot of listeners right now going, now, wait a minute. You know, the podcast era is telling me to perhaps practice sitting down, but my supervisor, licensing Eckers, is telling me that I need to be up and moving around and observing. And I love every opportunity to put myself and our listeners in this situation to start to make peace with the fact that what you've been told
may not be best practice.
Might not be best practice. Or might not be best practice anymore, mm-hmm. or might not be best practice with this group of children, or might not be best practice today. Because there's going to be another day where if somebody who just locks and loads at face value on, oh, well, that lady on the podcast said I should sit down. And so now you've got somebody who's not thinking. They just, again, they're doing what they feel somebody has told them they should be doing. They're not thinking. And then that's the day that somebody climbed up on the roof. And you know what? You should have got your ass up off the bench that day and gone in and seen it. But that podcast lady from Australia said, you know. And so at the end of the day, my goal is to have a talent pool that can think and can articulate the intention behind their choices on a regular daily basis. And I'm loving, you've broadened my mind tonight. And I want to say thank you. I haven't met you, but I'm moving in. I'm coming. I just bought a ticket, actually, Nikki.
And, oh, good. Yeah.
But thank you.
Now, I think you've got a very valid point there. I mean, I was also taught that you need to go and interact with those children. Uh-huh. Go and engage and interact. But I think if we use common sense, we're actually not their playmates. You know, we have a very important role, and that's to encourage them to socialize and to do all of that. Now, if you've got a child who can't socialize, yes, then you could be the playmate, and then you have to withdraw. So sometimes it's knowing when to. I always think of it as a dance, and mm-hmm. knowing when you have to lead and when you can step back,
and when you need to sit down.
Yes. And I think the important thing is that our duty is to be fully mindful of what we're seeing and what's happening, not to be thinking about our dinner or the disco we're going to go to or the glass of wine that's waiting for us in the fridge. It's you know, being totally there for the children, totally just being there.
Yeah, right here, and right now, in this moment.
Professional judgment. Yeah, right
present.
Here. And knowing when it is appropriate to get up and comment, or when is it appropriate just to give a little wink or a thumbs up. So when the child looks at you for affirmation, is to, you know, I'm so focused on what you're doing, I can see that you're looking for me for affirmation, and here's a little thumbs up. And I think you can be very engaged with the children without actually physically interfering with what they're doing and taking over the game, which so often happens.
I think if you think back at your own childhood, you're playing and you're engaged with friends and it's a multi-age group and you're outside, and then an adult gets close and your play changed.
Yep. And because that gate crashed.
Yeah, yeah.
You didn't invite them. They just came.
Yeah, they just showed up. And so you stopped your play or altered your play until they moved out of the environment, and then when you went back to your thing. And so just us being present can get in their way. I think the other thing, the good thing about us stepping back and sitting down is that children know where we are when they need us. And every once in a while, there's going to be a child who needs your attention for whatever reason, and they know where you are, and you're not busy picking up. and they can connect with you and engage with you as a person and recharge themselves or whatever it is they need from you while the other kids are busily engaged with each other.
Yeah, that's why I like a log or a bench that the children can actually join you.
Mm-hmm.
So very often I've got, you know, photographs with the adult sitting and she's, and then the children come and join and they come and tell us something and then they move off again and they come back again. I've got one lovely picture where the adult looks like she's pondering and the little girl stands next to her and she does exactly the same movement with her hand. So she's pondering. So she's copying from the adult what the adult is, you know, thinking about. I think we have to get much better at being reflective practitioners or educators.
Mm-hmm.
So that we think about what we do and also the intention, as Lisa said, the intentionality behind what we are doing. Because I think, I'm not going to say it too loud, Lisa, because we've got men on the forum, but I think as women we talk too much.
Well, I know we do. I know we do.
We tend to, you know, the children are playing beautifully and we'll walk past and say something. When actually, are we actually contributing to the value of their play by saying beautiful sharing? Or are we again just talking for the sake of talking? And I think very often it's talking for the sake of talking.
Because I got to get the nap mats out and the cots together and I got to get the kids to the bus and I got to get the snack out and I got to get the... And I'm like, just shush.
Or you just want to look to other people like you are interacting with the kids. Because I know I've felt that pressure in jobs before where I'm like, okay, I have to like... Someone's in here. Someone's watching us. I have to go over to these two kids who are just playing by themselves. I'm just like, what you doing? Like, it's so unauthentic and so horrible. And I'm so glad I work for myself now because that would drive me insane.
I wonder, this is Tiffany. Hey. I wonder how much of that need to move and the need to talk comes from that self-conscious perspective of... What if my boss comes by and sees me sitting on my buns? I got to look like I'm doing something all the time.
Yeah.
When really, if you were, if you are a reflective and engaged educator, that's what it looks like, is sitting down and reflecting and engaging with each child as they need it.
And you might have a little prop. So I've said to a lot of educators that really struggle with that, especially because, as you say, we tend to be people pleasers in our profession.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to please the parents who might walk past in the road, the director of the center, the inspector. We try to please everybody. And I very often suggest to get a little notepad. And while you're sitting and watching, you write in there what you're hearing. You can write what you're thinking. Children might come and say, what you're doing? And you say, I'm just writing down all the great stuff you're doing. And they might say, can I help you? And then you'll say, here's the pad. And then they'll can do a bit of, you know, their little emergent writing, and then they'll go off and play, and then you go back to your... So sometimes having a prop like a little notepad is a good transition period, also to show the director or the owner that you are actually there. You know, it's not just... You're not just sitting on your bum thinking about your split ends or you're looking at your French nails.
My split ends. Nikki, I used to teach the teachers I mentored. I used to call this active observation because I found initially in my first foray into talking with other teachers that this was a huge struggle spot. So I tried to figure out what that was about. And I really do think that the people in our profession struggle with looking. They feel that they look like they're not doing anything. And I sit here, my head just popped off my body because that is exactly what I used to tell them. Get one of those little notebooks, put it in your pocket and sit. If you're doing, write it down, make it, capture it. But you're using then that information to then deepen your practice the next day or the next hour or that afternoon. You're not just writing stuff down randomly. I mean, there's journaling and then there's active documenting. This art of active documentation and active observation is very, very tricky for a lot of people in the profession.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the reflecting.
It's because there's no time.
Yeah, well, you know what? There is when we start to deconstruct what we think our schedule should look like.
Yeah, when we sit down, when we step back and sit down.
There's a lot of time.
We can create, we create the time. Yeah. But we feel like
there's... That's reflection time.
Yeah, we feel like there's so much rush. Hey, Nikki, when it comes to the risky play, If you're in a program that hasn't really embraced the value of this, and you listen to this episode or listen to the recordings you and I did, I mean, we spent 3 hours talking about the topic, so there's a lot of good content there. If you're in one of those programs and you're looking at making some transitions into being more supportive of risk, whether it's physical or social or emotional, how do programs go about starting that process?
That's a good question. I need time to think about that. Travis, what do you think? Lisa, what do you think?
Well, what I said under my breath was get a notebook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've also seen a lot of centers, especially the ones that I go and talk to, their first mode of change is they say, okay, let's get something that they can climb on in the classroom. And then what they do is I tell people to go buy old bunk beds and slap it in your classroom, and then right. They can climb on it. Because if you're having a problem with kids getting up on shelves, where's somewhere that they can climb? And so I've seen a lot of places do that. And what they do is they start with this giant yoga mat around the bunk bed, giant yoga mat, so that if the kids were to happen to fall, they'd at least fall on something soft. And then they And then every week that yoga mat gets shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. And it's not even for the kids. And it's
I was
not
just going
to
say that is it's, so not for the yeah, children.
It's not for the kids, but just in their head, they need that safety net. And this can be applied to so many things. You need that safety net just at first for you so that you know that, okay, I don't need to be watching all the time, but what if something happens? And so just seeing that the visual of that's getting shorter every week and nobody's getting hurt. Nobody needed it.
Yeah.
Nobody needed it ever. Nobody fell on it. And just seeing stuff like that happen, that could happen with so many things. Just making sure
I wonder if
happens.
The yoga mat people got in on that as some kind of safety zone.
Yeah, they
sponsorship.
They got to be getting a kickback.
They sell those yoga mat pieces and puzzle pieces, and that's how they do it. Is they you put them together and then you can pull them back one by one.
Oh yeah, that flooring type stuff.
Yeah.
It's
made out of the yoga mat material, and it's stuff like that. As long as there's some kind of visual for the teachers or something that they can see and understand. That it's that this the way we're doing it is going away, but we're taking it as you can handle it, so that nobody stresses themselves out and heads out the door because they're I don't want to work at the crazy center anymore.
Yeah, they sometimes it's small steps.
Yeah, small.
Well, some people
that way. Yeah. Those small steps. Hey, Nikki, one thing.
And also to look at the benefits of risk taking. I think that's when I do professional development, it's about let's have a look at the benefits first.
Yeah,
we call that a risk benefit analysis.
Yeah, and let's go there, Nick, because the way Nikki prefers to phrase it is benefit risk assessment, and I love the idea of putting
benefit, your brain hears benefit first.
Putting the benefit first. Because,
hold on, I'm writing something down.
Okay, we'll write it down.
Go on.
And so when it comes to making this change, I think, and then we'll get into the assessments. I think one of the big things we can do is get parents together. And
it says
together.
Bra. Sorry.
What?
It's bra.
Benefit
bra.
Risk assessment.
That's right.
Now I'm going to remember it.
I'm glad you're going to remember
it. Sorry, you were saying
something
so profound.
For the parents making these transitions, I think when we can get them together with food and beverages and get them around our either literal or metaphorical campfire and share stories and get parents telling stories about risk-taking and play when they were children, I think it makes makes the ideas more accessible and digestible to them when programs start talking about change. And I've had some good success with that. And so, Nikki, the benefit risk assessments, what's that all about?
Well, what I tend to do is I look at the benefits first. Now, the looking at benefit risk, the first time I heard it was about 2004, 2005, and it was a group in England with Tim Gill and Bernard Spiegel and David Bohr created a document in England, a Play England document about risk. And in there, they talked about the risk-benefit assessment. So looking at the risks and benefits, and then I just prefer to put benefits first because I think we need to look at, why look at the negative first? We look at the positive first.
Mm-hmm.
And then we look at what are the obstacles or what are the dangers or the risks? And then we look at, how can we still make it happen? Because we've got all these benefits there. So how can we still make it happen through putting in procedures that maybe reduce the risks? But what a lot of people do is that they reduce the risks. They put so many procedures in, and they reduce the risks so that there's no, you actually lose the benefits. So you keep having to look to see, is it still going to be fun? Because that can be a benefit if we put all these procedures in to reduce the risks. And I don't know if you've heard of the concept of good and bad hazards. And again, this comes from the Play England document. We're looking at what hazards are good and what hazards are bad. And a good hazard is something that has the potential to be risky, but it has benefits to the child, so developmental benefits, and also the children can see it is risky. So that is a good hazard. And fire would fall into that. Heights, children know when they are high and when they are low. So those are good hazards. And then the bad hazards are things that have no developmental benefits to children, and also the children can't see that it's risky. So, for example, most children that end up in accident and emergency with fall accidents tend to be children who have fallen less than a meter because to them they're not high, it's not dangerous, so they're not careful. As soon as you go above that, children are extra cautious. Same with having the rubber surfacing underneath, children think they're safe. Whereas if you have it on concrete, children know they're not safe if they fall, so they just hold on a little bit tighter. So I like the idea of looking at good and bad hazards and then reducing those. I also think in my benefit risk assessments, I actually add a column that says children's voices. What do the children say about it? Because I think the whole, you know, when we do a benefit risk assessment, we should involve the children and get them to think about how do they keep themselves safe. Because my motto is always, you know, we cannot keep children safe. The only way children can keep safe is if they can keep themselves safe. So they need to be aware of procedures that they can help implement and why we have rule, you know, why we have those procedures. So my benefit risk assessment has a column that says benefits. It's got a column that says children's voices. And it could be a child saying, that's prickly, or that's high. It could also be a child saying, it's fun. So then you know, the children do the benefit and the risks in their column. And then I've got identifying the hazards and the procedures to put in. So I like the idea of hazards. And I think what we have to get away from in the childcare environment is to look at it at the same level as you would in industry or in a factory. Because risk assessments were, you know, the health and safety brigade and all of that started with factories where people were, you know, where there's no benefit to risky opportunities. Whereas in a social environment, whether that is skydiving or whether that is mountain climbing or whether that is motor racing, that's a social environment. And childcare should be a social environment. We do need to, there are benefits to risk. And whether that is motor racing because it gives you an adrenaline fix, I'm not saying put all the children into motor racing, racing cars. But it's just to say that, you know, as humans, we like to challenge ourselves.
Yeah.
And we like to, you know, we like to look for these risks. And there's a lot of research, a lot of people have done research on the benefits of risk and children undertaking these risky opportunities. So I think it's really important that we value this and that this is documented. And also that we share that documentation with parents to say, look, this is, if you're working in a childcare environment, I always get the parents to look at what we do because parents don't write risk assessments. They don't know what we're looking at. They don't know why we allow children to climb. Because maybe once in 50 years, a child might fall off the tree. Whereas what we're saying is all the benefits the child gets from that. So I think it's really important that we share that with parents. And, you know, I've found massive mind shifts by just saying to people, look at the benefits first.
Yeah, and the reality is parents want the best for their children. It's just that they get so much input from the media and the interwebs and peers that they don't always have a clear and concise and realistic and research-based view of what the best looks like. And so we, as professional practitioners, need to be a little bit better at clarifying those things for them.
Yeah, and then Tim Gill always says, don't benchmark down at the level of the most anxious parent. Because we do that. Good, isn't it? Because we do that. You have one parent who has a problem with children climbing, and then we ban climbing.
Say that again for me. Say it again so I can write it down. Don't benchmark.
If don't benchmark down at the level of the most anxious parent.
Thank you. Is that you or somebody else?
And I would even say educator as well, because sometimes you'll have one person in a center who is risk averse because they have a fear of heights and they won't allow the children to climb. So it's just looking at common sense. And I think part of the problem is, I mentioned earlier on, is that when we work in a nurturing environment like childcare, we tend to be people pleasers.
Mm-hmm.
So we try and please everybody. And I think sometimes the child and the value and the importance of what the child needs gets lost because we're trying to please everybody around us.
Everybody but the child.
Well, their voices are the smallest, and they often don't really have a voice. So it's really being aware of who are we doing this for. And I always say I'll fight any battle if I know there's a benefit for the children.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, we went a little bit after the past the 30-minute mark. I was thinking that we'd go.
She's ready for lunch.
But I expected that. Yeah, there's probably a flock of birds.
You can drink a glass of wine now.
There's probably a flock of birds on Nikki's patio.
Not yet.
The birds are on Nikki's patio waiting for their lunch.
They're hungry.
They were yelling at us when we were videoing the other day. And so Nikki, any closing thoughts or ideas on risky play that we should leave our listeners with before we wrap things up?
Well, I love the quote from Bundy, who says, the biggest risk is that there's no risk.
Oh, wow.
Is that profound enough?
I think that pretty much wraps it up. Nikki, I love talking to you, and I can't wait to see you in 30 days or so. We're going to be back in Australia, and we're going to get together for that ginger beer and hang out and hopefully get to, if we don't get to have any adventures, we'll at least get to have a couple good conversations. I appreciate your time.
Maybe you and I should be jumping off the Glen Elg jetty this time.
I don't know how to swim. I would drown and die, but
you and Tasha
are welcome to jump this time. This has been the Child Care Bar and Grill podcast. I'm Jeff Johnson with Travis and Nikki and Lisa and Tiffany. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with another episode. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And the recording is almost stopped. Now is it stopped? Is it stopped yet, Tiffany? Have you pushed stop? This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.
Oh.
Hey, you want to support all the Upstairs Studio podcasts? It's as simple as this. Use our Amazon link when you shop Amazon. We get a small percentage of what you spend. You don't pay any extra. You get your stuff from Amazon. Everybody wins. Where do you find the link? Well, it's on the Explorations Early Learning app. You can find it on the Explorations Early Learning website. If you don't find it in those places, just get a hold of Jeff on Facebook or via email, and he'll hand deliver it to your inbox. Thanks for your support. Bye-bye.